Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today because we are talking with an author about her new book, which tracks the life of a 19th century spiritualist and some of the moral conundrums she faced. Great to have back Sarah Rath with me. She's the author of 15 books. She and I have talked about several of her books. She has three novels, Star Lake Saloon and Housekeeping Cottages, another Night Sisters, and also The Waters of Star Lake, and did a biography of H.H. Bennett, photographer, his American Landscape, all great books. Her latest is 7 Years of Grace, The Inspired Mission of Axa Sprague. And thank you so much for joining us today, Sarah. Appreciate it very much.
Love to be here, Larry.
Well, I tell you what, it's interesting to me. Now, you did write a book that involved spiritualism at one point. Why the interest in the life of a mid-19th century spiritualist medium?
It was all because I read about her in a book called Feminism and the 19th Century. And I saw the picture that accompanied the article, and it was the picture that's on the cover of the book, which I thought was very
really
engaging.
Cool photo.
Yeah, I know, and kind of contemporary in a way. And there's something about her eyes that that gaze was very inviting and looked like there was a story behind them. So I noticed there was a footnote accompanying the article that said her letters and diaries and writings were all in the archives of the Vermont Historical Society, so I went to Vermont. And I was familiar with Vermont because I got my MFA in writing at Vermont College in Montpelier, and I taught at Goddard College in Plainfield for 4 years. So I went to the Historical Society and looked at the archives, and they had amassed such a large collection of papers, which no one had ever decided to put together in a book. I felt...
Couldn't believe it.
I wanted to read more about her, but nobody had written the book, and so I thought, I'm going to have to write the book. I don't know if she was right there encouraging me to write it, but the more research I did over the years, I think that she did encourage me to write a book about her life.
Well, it's an interesting story. We can get into that as we go along. Your whole research on this was really, really interesting. Wonderful. And I want to give our listeners a chance to join in. What do you think about spiritualism? Diaries play a big role in this. Do you keep a diary, and why? Have you had to reconstruct somebody, maybe a long-lost family member's history through their diaries and other papers? To me, it's a very, very fascinating process. Join in with your own questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or if you want to go ahead and post on our Facebook page, please do. Just go to The Larry Mueller Show. That is the title of our Facebook page. So I'd love to hear from you. So, Axa Sprague has some Wisconsin connections.
Yes, she did. She had a sister named Celia who moved here in 1853 and began teaching school in Oakfield, which is south of Fond du Lac. And when I decided to write the book, I played around with the voice and the narrator and the tone, and I rewrote the book 3 or 4 times, and it's a very long book.
It is.
It was longer. I like a long book when I get it really involved with a story. So this is not a thin book. And I decided that I wanted to tell the story from Celia's point of view, because sisters can be, they can be very loving toward their sisters, or they can be more critical. They can see them more objectively, I think, than just a narrator, and I wanted a more personal touch. I wanted Celia to be able to talk about Axa. Plus, there were a lot of letters from Celia to Axa in the files that I found in Vermont. So I was able to derive a lot about her life and a lot about her relationship with her sister. And in those days, when people wrote letters, they would often say, in your last letter, you said blah, 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 blah. So I would know what Axa had said to Celia, and then I would know what Celia responded. So it was a real gift.
Oh, and I think you really, I think that was an excellent choice. I don't know how else you'd, I guess there are other ways you could have written it, but...
Well, it was intriguing to me, living in Wisconsin, to know what life was like here in the 1850s. And I read a lot of books about Vermont women who moved to Wisconsin during that period of time. A lot of them did. They fell in love with someone in Vermont who bought a plot of land in the Midwest.
Oh.
And then they'd come back, they'd build a one-room cabin, then they'd go back east and get their wife from their beautiful New England home and bring them...
Here.
Yeah, it's kind of a dirty trick. And then bring them west by train. This was as far as the train came at that time. And they'd find there was a log house with a rough floor, maybe a blanket over the window. Indian trails were the only roads in some areas. It was a pretty rugged life, and some of those diaries were very sad to read. But I wanted to know what they were like, because that's what Celia had to contend with when she came out here.
Did you give the years? I don't...
Exa was born in 1827, and Celia came out here in 1853. Now, Wisconsin became a state in 1848, so that mm-hmm. gives you a kind of a setting for...
And Exa herself, she was initially pretty shy and pretty sickly.
She was not exactly shy. She was very active. She was extremely bright. She began teaching school at the age of 12.
Yeah.
Yeah, get that. One of her students was Calvin Coolidge's father in the elementary grades, because the Plymouth Notch, the hamlet of Plymouth Notch where she grew up, is the place where Calvin Coolidge was born. And the whole hamlet is now under the protection of the National Historic Places. So it's very small, but her grave is very close, just within steps of the Coolidge graves. And it's a marvelous place to visit. In fact, I'll be going out there in June, and the state of Vermont is going to erect a historical marker at Axe's home site, which is quite a thrill for me.
Oh, it's got to be. Well, tell us about, or talk about the event that sort of changed her process. And actually, before that, how do you get, at 12 years old, how do you teach? I mean,
well,
she's got to be that smart.
I think at the time, did you ever go to a one-room school?
I did.
Okay, well, I think the smartest students were asked to help with some of the younger students. Did that happen to you? Were you the one that was chosen?
I was not.
Okay, well, I think that's how she got involved. And then she got older and she became the teacher. And I think that the Coolidge connection was probably when in the elementary grades. She was a very robust girl, very active, rode horses, played with the boys. But then she became ill around the age of 20 with what they called a scrofulous disease, which was very crippling for her. Must have been a kind of rheumatism. And she was confined to a dark room for years and years. And this is when she started keeping her diary. And her first entry was June 1st, 1849, when she wrote, "Once more, I am unable to walk or do anything else, have not been a step without crutches since Sunday, and see no prospect of being any better, see nothing before me but a life of miserable helplessness."
Wow.
And, yes, her poetry written during that time was pretty dour. There's a book came out of her poems after her death, and there's a section that says early poems. You kind of want to stay away from those. They're really downers. But she was getting out a lot of her emotions out on paper, so that perhaps helped her feel better.
Well, and then there was a huge event.
Yes. In 1853, she raged against God. She was so mad. She had planned out this life for herself. She wanted to get further education. She was a big reader. She just wanted to do things and be involved. She was so much involved with women's rights, and she was so outspoken about these things, and she wanted to become more productive. And she was angry with God, and then the way she told it, there was this explosive view of angel wings that came upon her, and it was her guardian angels, and they said that she would be cured, but as compensation for her cure, she would have to travel the country and tell the world about spiritualism and the fact that we do not die. And if you visit Axe's grave in Plymouth Notch, you will see that engraved on the tombstone are the words, "I still live."
Amazing. And she became part of a sort of a spiritualist community then?
Well, there was quite an interest in spiritualism at that time, and a lot of intellectuals were involved with spiritualism because they were for the abolition of slavery, they were for women's rights, they were for women's suffrage, and she became a traveling medium. She started out in Vermont and then New Hampshire and then New England and then Philadelphia, Connecticut, upstate New York. She got as far west as Chicago, Milwaukee, Madison, Fond du Lac, Davenport, Iowa. This is just prior to the Civil War. St. Louis, Memphis, Terre Haute, Indiana. It was a dangerous time to be that far south and be a Yankee, and she was so worried that the spirits who spoke through her and brought these words to her, which she delivered while in a self-imposed trance, would say something about the abolition of slavery when she was in Memphis, for example. So that made her very nervous because a previous visit by a spiritualist medium then involved a huge rock being thrown through the window of the church, but she was okay.
Let's go back to this. The whole business of her being a medium, how would you define it? What is a medium? And how does one become one?
I think the word medium means you're in between this life and another life. And what she did was speak for those on the other side. And her guardian angels would put words in her mouth or cause her to sing a hymn that she would be inspired to sing that no one else had ever sung. And so she was, she improvised. She improvised with the words that the angels gave her.
How did she get around? How did she get to these places? I mean, there's a lot of traveling involved.
Yes, and she traveled alone, which was very unusual. She went by train, which wasn't the most comfortable way to travel in those days because your clothes got full of soot and it was smelly and the seats were hard and the train would stop. You had to hop off and get something to eat, get back on the train, get going, or by stagecoach. When she came to Madison, the train came to Sun Prairie and then she had to take a stagecoach to Madison.
Man.
And Madison streets were not terrific in those days.
Oh, man. Sarah Rath, our guest today, talking with her about her latest book. It's titled 7 Years of Grace, The Inspired Mission of AXA W. Sprague. You can join in with your question. What do you think of spiritualism? Have you kept a diary? I think I want to talk a little bit more about the whole diary business with Sarah here. Have you had to reconstruct someone? Give us a call with your own questions at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer, Marika Suval, our producer here on the Ideas Network. At 2 o'clock, this week's edition of All Things Political takes place, of course, and Kathleen Dunn and her guest will be reviewing the top political news of the week, including ongoing coverage of the presidential election. That's at 2 o'clock. Right now, though, we're talking with Sarah Rath about her book, 7 Years of Grace, The Inspired Mission of AXA Sprague. And join in with your own questions, comments, experiences at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or again, post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And I just want to go back to this. What was really another interesting part of this whole thing was your quest to get this information and these diaries.
Yes, I did a blog about it, which is available on the UW Press website. The book is published by the Vermont Historical Society, and it's being marketed also by UW Press, in case anybody's interested. I hope everybody's interested. Mm-hmm. Yes, the diaries were purchased at Tuttle's Bookstore in Rutland, Vermont, by a man named Leonard Twinnum, and he took them to the Vermont Historical Society to be published in an abridged form in 1941 in their proceedings. And I was able to read them when I went to Vermont, and they were very interesting, except Mr. Twinnum was a Presbyterian minister, and he had edited the diaries. Yes. Well, He had all these ellipses throughout, and I thought, were those because the diary was boring then or because he was a Presbyterian minister? Yeah. So I was very eager to find the original diaries and to find out what they said. Well, the Historical Society had no copies of the original diaries. Twinham's brother had given over the letters that he had purchased at the same time in 1976, but the diaries were not there. So I began this obsessive quest to find, truly, to find out more about Twinham. I looked online at every archive in every college and university across the country, every antiquarian bookstore, every antiquarian archive, everybody I could possibly write to, the Presbyterian archives, historians everywhere to try and find out. I mean, there was not a box I did not check looking for information about where these diaries could be unless they had been destroyed. And I didn't think Twinham would destroy things because in Sharon, Connecticut, where he lived, the Historical Society said he was known as kind of an eccentric man who was always bringing stuff in, but not the diaries. So I looked everywhere. And the most unusual thing happened. They appeared on eBay 3 years ago.
Isn't that amazing?
Yes. You can imagine, forehead, palm to forehead. Oh. Oh, my God, what are these doing here? So the librarian at Vermont Historical Society, Paul Carnahan, and I started bidding on these diaries. The person selling them said that he'd purchased them in an auction in New York. They didn't know anything about the author, but they, when they found out who had written them, they knew they were something very important. Well, we bid and we bid, and finally we had to give up. They went for $5,000.
Oh, man.
Still have no idea who bought them. We asked him to send emails to the person who purchased them so that we could just look at them. I wanted to find out what was left out, and no response.
Oh.
So I have no idea who could have gotten them. I saw a picture on eBay of what, you know, the big size of the...
Oh, man.
But no, I couldn't find it, and that's still a mystery to me. But I did have all of the letters, and I made a timeline of her life, and it was easy to figure out where she was when, and meshed the diary with the letters and made a story. And one of the things that was very interesting about the letters, I had this friend from Vermont copy the letters and send them to me because there are over 1,000 letters to her, plus other pieces of writing that she had done that nobody had really identified as such. One piece of paper was written backwards, and you could only read it in a mirror.
Uh-huh.
So, and it was obviously her handwriting. So Caroline, who was going through these letters, wrote to me that John Crawford's letters were all done on blue stationery. John Crawford was a Great Lakes shipping magnate who, with his partner Philo Chamberlain, owned about 20 propeller-driven ships that hauled merchandise from Ogdensburg, New York, to Chicago. He was married, had 5 children, and his wife was a spiritualist. And when he met AXA, his heart flipped, and he fell in love with her. Well, at that time, the spiritualists were promoting something called free love, which all the news...
We kind of all know about what that means.
Well, then it meant something very different, Larry.
It did.
Yes. The newspapers made fun of it and called it free lust, which is maybe the kind that you're thinking of. But when you were a spiritualist and believed in free love in the 1850s, that meant that if you had a person that you were fond of who was also a spiritualist and had spiritual guardians, if you wanted to have a love relationship with this person, even physical, it wasn't really you who had to take the responsibility for it because it was really your spiritual parts that were doing this. So there was no guilt involved. But AXA was strident.
She didn't believe in that, did she?
No, she was stridently against it, but that was the interesting thing about those blue letters, because I found out that eventually she caved.
Yeah.
And they had a relationship that was so meaningful and was so deep, and so it was a cat and mouse game. It was a source of entertainment and passion that I was just stunned by. It was like she had this secret. You know, I told you that when I looked into her eyes, I saw this glance. Yeah. It's like she was holding this story in there. And when I found that, I thought, oh, my God, this is going to be a book. This is the heart of the book. And it truly is.
Yeah, it truly is. Roy in Waukegan, Illinois has a comment for us. Hi, Roy. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. I take it you really don't believe in it, though.
Oh, no. Go ahead and tell me. What are your thoughts?
Well, my thought is one of the big spirits was of the 19th century was Abraham Lincoln.
That's very true, yes. He did consult a medium. His wife, Mary Lincoln, was very much involved with spiritualism because she wanted to contact their son who had died. And I've heard that they did have a seance in the White House.
They all were that way. And as far as what went on there, matter is neither created nor destroyed. And what we do when we die is we graduate on to the higher plane.
That's right, yes. Are you a spiritualist?
Oh, probably in the abstract way I am, but it's just really funny, though.
Well, I don't disagree with the fact that spirits can be in touch with us. I've had some experiences myself, and my husband also did. He consulted a spiritualist medium when we were out at Lilydale, which is a spiritualist community in upstate New York, and he got a reading. And when the reading was over, the medium, who was from England, said to him, oh, by the way, Joe says to say hi. Now, there was no way that that person could have known that Joe was the nickname of his former wife who had died.
Yeah.
I guess there's just so much evidence there to show that when we graduate from this plane of existence, we graduate into a higher plane.
Well, Roy, I thank you so much for calling. I appreciate your call very much. And I want to give, actually, Kathy a chance to join in next. Kathy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm actually a medium. I attended the Spiritualist Church, but because I was ordained in another church, I had to give up my ordination in order to be a member, and I chose not to do that. But I've had a son who crossed over, and he comes through all the time. He comes through with my cat.
Through your cat?
He used to be a firefighter, paramedic. And when he's around, my cat slaps water all over.
That's a wonderful story, Kathy.
Oh, that's do you have other folks come to you or say to you something similar to that, Kathy?
Me?
Yeah,
oh.
Sarah?
Well, there is a spiritualist camp in Wisconsin called Waniwok, which I wrote about in Night Sisters. And people can go up there and consult with mediums and have a reading if they would like and see if the medium is able to contact someone in the spirit world who has a message for them.
Very, very interesting. Thank you so much, Kathy, for calling. Appreciate it. Let's turn to Judy next in New Berlin. Judy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Oh, hi, Larry. Thanks for putting me on. I just wanted to share with your audience. My mother, Ada Miller, kept a day-by-day diary from 1935 through 1940. And she grew up in town of Jackson in Washington County, a farm family. And it gives a real detailed account of what life was like on the farm, the joys and sorrows and all, you know, the crops and all the parties and that. And my daughter, Kelly, is very interested in genealogy and that. So she transcribed the diaries, and we have a big family reunion every other year. And in the 2014 one, we had 150 people come. And we had the transcribed diary there, and it was just continuously being read by somebody.
That's a marvelous story. I'm so happy to hear that.
Yeah, and it's just, and we're going to have a family reunion again this summer. So we've got the aunts and uncles are all gone, but we've got, and I'm one of the oldest cousins, so we're all writing something, a memory that we remember, and mine is going to be the egg route. I grew up on a farm, and we had chickens, hundreds of them, and my dad had an egg route in Milwaukee. Every Friday, he peddled eggs to customers.
I think that's great, and you're all going to have an excerpt in this publication that you're putting together.
Right, right, right.
Oh, what a great idea.
That's priceless, really.
Yeah, and we feel very fortunate that we've been able to keep the traditions going, and that at the family reunion, people, we have it every other year so that people can plan ahead, and they come from all over the country just to come back for that event.
That's really nice.
Great.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much for calling. And you know, obviously, Sarah, for you, the importance of diaries, I mean, in your case, for some of your work, and for anybody else, I mean, if you, to have that history.
Well, I keep a diary, mm-hmm. or a journal, or whatever you want to call it. I have since college. And the problem is sometimes I get so wrapped up in other stuff that I can't, you know, I've missed a few days. Then I have to go back and try to fill in what I did and the blanks. But, you know, what's helpful is email, because I can go back through the emails that I've sent on certain days. Like if I've sent my daughter or my son an email and said, well, today I blah, 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 blah. So then I can just take that out and put it in my journal, and it doesn't look like I skipped a day. It doesn't look like I'm cheating. But, yes, it's when I go back through those old diaries from the 1960s and 70s, from when my children were toddlers and growing up, I just sit there and cry sometimes because I've kept track of their first words and funny things that they did, and my own life at the time when it was in turmoil or when it was especially happy. And I have, you know, my husband will confirm, boxes and boxes and boxes of these. But it's a validation of one's life.
Yeah.
And I have a very close friend who died a couple of months ago who had also kept a daily diary. And she frequently talked about how people were going to read it after she died. And she didn't punctuate it. She just wrote her thoughts. But she became ill with cancer, and she died within 2 months. And one of the last things she did was have a bonfire and burn her diaries.
Oh.
I know. And I said, that's exactly what I said. Oh, and my other friend who was sitting next to me gave me an elbow in the ribs and said, it's done. Be quiet. And I think it was because death came upon her so quickly, and there were probably people around about whom she had written, and she didn't want them to know what she had said. So, but I still felt, oh, such a waste. She could have given them to the Historical Society or said, keep these under lock and key for 25 years, or some way to preserve all of those years of her children growing up, her marriage, their moves, the friends they'd had. I was sick at heart about it. Well, more sick at heart about losing her, but just losing that treasure.
Oh, man. Well, I have a friend whose grandmother died at 92, and she started a diary, I think she was 12. And every year, and boxes and boxes and boxes, and in a nice diary book.
So oh, wow.
She always had a diary book, and so much fun to go back. You kind of laugh sometimes because you certainly know the weather every day in the Watertown area. But the other thing I kind of laughed about was she was a huge Chicago Cubs fan. So the Chicago Cubs score was in every game. So we knew the score of the Chicago Cubs for every game. Well, great to talk about those. You may have a question or comment or an experience to share as well, and I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mealer Show. Love to hear from you. And before we go back to the phones, this whole relationship she had with her, what she called her evil genius.
That's right, yes.
Talk about that a bit more.
Well, he was a very well-educated man. Actually, he had worked in an Oneida Indian school with his older sister up near Green Bay when he was a teenager, which was kind of interesting. I couldn't find anything more about that. But he was very well educated, and he was also a poet. And Axa was a poet. As I said, she'd written very sad poetry when she was ill, but she perked up and wrote better poetry, more uplifting poetry when she was feeling better. And he mentored her. And he helped her so that her poetry was not just the typical Victorian woman rhyming poems. And some of her later poems are absolutely stunning, really, really beautiful. And so they wrote poems together. You know, a lot of their relationship was by mail. And, of course, I have these letters from him that said, you wrote these lines, and these are the ones I think should follow. And they did hymns that are still in the Spiritualist Church hymnals today. His name was John Crawford, and her name was A.W. Sprague, and you can find hymns that they wrote together. I think he would write a verse, and she would write a verse, and it was really interesting. He would often write to her from the owner's room in the steamship, and said that that's the only place where he could get away from the noise. And he took her on trips on the boats, and apparently the owner's quarters were extremely luxurious, with mirrors and velvets and gilded things. And
be fun to see those, wouldn't it?
I know. So she had a special pass so she could travel on those when she came to Chicago, for example. When she traveled, she didn't always come by train. She could come by steamboat.
Amazing. We have Jerry in Glendale up next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Oh, hi. My father was very close to his mother. His father had died when he was just a senior in high school, so at the start of the Depression, he and his mother really formed quite a close relationship. My grandmother passed away in 1963, and about a month after Grandma died, my dad was sitting in the family room watching television. He thought he had dozed off. He opened his eyes, and there's his mother standing in front of him. And she was dressed in just a regular house dress like she normally would. He blinked his eyes, and he said, "Ma, is that you?" And she said, "Yes, it is. It's me." He said, "Have you seen Pa yet?" And she said, "No, I haven't." And he said, "Are you okay?" And she said, "I'm fine." Well, the next thing he knows, there's nobody there, and he tells me that he thought it was a dream. Now, my dad was one of these bedrock, down-to-earth people who would never make anything up, and I think he had a pretty good grasp of reality. And so I'm quite convinced that my grandmother's spirit, knowing how close the two of them were, I just have a clear sense that Grandma Nellie came back to reassure my father that she was fine.
Oh.
I believe you. I think that's a wonderful story, and I can document that. Before I mentioned, my husband received a message from a medium. His wife died very suddenly, and after her death, one night he woke up and she was standing there, and he asked if she was all right, and she said yes, and he said, "Well, will you be coming back?" And she said, "That depends on the permitter," which really an interesting word. And the thing is, Del and I met on an airplane. We were seated together twice on Midwest Express. And I, to this day, I believe we've had such a good marriage for 25 years. I think that she brought us together.
Oh, what a great story. Gary, thank you so much for calling as well. Appreciate your call. Well, what was her... Going back to AXA. Yeah, back to AXA for a minute. What do you suppose? What was her impact? What difference did she make as she spoke around the country?
Well, she spoke before audiences of thousands, if you can imagine, without a microphone. And she often suffered from minister's sore throat, which was common in those days because of trying to project your voice. And for example, she spoke in Fond du Lac, and her sister Celia, who had never heard her speak before, was very interested in hearing her and seeing her on the stage. And actually, this was in the Congregational Church.
So, yeah, can you read a little?
Sure. Soon the lights were dimmed and Axie appeared before us. Only a few hours before, I had fastened the tiny buttons on the back of her emerald silk dress with my own trembling fingers. I had brushed and helped fasten her hair. She joked that I was welcome to join in her travels, as it would be pleasant to have an assistant who understood her needs and so served as a companion, since her task was often lonely. I could help you memorize your lectures, I added with a friendly jab of my elbow. That's because she'd been accused by others of delivering memorized lectures, which she swore she did not. Indeed, she replied with amusement, I'm in dire need of fresh sermons to replace the threadbare ones Now the Axa who stood before us seemed a wholly different person. Her eyes were focused somewhere other than within the sanctuary where we convened. Conversations quieted, and from the silence arose a voice that could have belonged to a stranger. She began by singing a hymn. She had assured me that she knew not what it would entail, but she was confident that spirits would inspire the necessary words and music. I seek no homage from the crowd, though hushed in silence long. I sing at last because my soul will pour itself in song. Because a fountain leaps within whose ever-dashing spray can catch the light and bear it back like golden beams of day. After several verses of the hymn, she spoke of an invisible cord that entwined from every human mind and reached to the great beyond to provide power and strength for our own inspiration. When I'm alone with this deep unknown, she said, this power is strongest. When my thoughts are pure, this power showers my soul with nature's essence, the spirits of the beautiful and free. There are brighter things to come before whose beauty the earth shall sit dumb.
Wonderful. Oh, that's a wonderful part of the book. And she was a really fascinating person. I'm so glad. And you kind of feel like, I think you talk about her as a spirit sister.
Yes. Well, because I felt compelled to write the book after I began reading her writings, and because I didn't think anybody else would. Also, I'm a poet. As I said, I've spent a lot of time in Vermont. I was open to spiritualism. I was not, you know, against the idea that spirits can commune with us. And I have felt all along that she's been with me. You know, I wrote all of those other books, but I always return to AXA. This took me about 15 years of research. So, yes, so I would always pick her up between books, and I never got tired of it. Now, there was something that happened in the last year of her life that was quite extraordinary, and that was that she became ill in Oswego, New York, where John Crawford was then living, and he took her into his home to nurse her. His wife was then in Milwaukee with one of their daughters who was having a baby. And, of course, he had a nurse take care of her. But their relationship deepened even more, and she was finally well enough to go back to Plymouth Notch, where she died. But it was an astonishing part of her life, and I think a very dramatic portion of the book.
A very dramatic portion. And, Sarah, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Wonderful, a wonderful story. Oh, my goodness.
Thank you, Larry. And I wanted to tell, you're going to ask me what my next book is, aren't you?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to do another Northwoods novel because I wanted to do three of those. I want to do a trilogy. It's going to involve a murder and clowns.
A lot different from 7 Years of Grace. Well, yes. I can't wait for that one.
Okay, I'll meet you in a couple of years right here, okay?
Sounds like a plan. Thank you, Sarah.
Thanks, Larry.
Sarah Rath, take a look at this. Her book. It's called The Search. No, I'm sorry. 7 Years of Grace, The Inspired Mission of AXA W. Sprague. The author, our guest today, Sarah Rath. And she'll be back with us probably in a year or two, and we'll talk about another book of hers coming up. Oh, my goodness me. What fun. I tell you. Well, it's going to be fun coming up, too, because I have another author with us today. We'll be taking a look at Teddy Roosevelt and the Rough Riders, two very different books today, and both great reads here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.